Part 3, The Dying of the Light. Chapter 23, Secret Ways, Primary Location Alpha, Master of the Mountain. High in orbit, aboard the teleportation deck on the Lord Shadow, Krukesh and Scryvok watched the hololith in silence. Barabbas Dantioch, the renegade warsmith, went about his business, unaware that he was being observed. The small hololith projector buzzed loudly, disturbed by unknown forms of interference.
"Fascinating, Scryvok," said Krukesh. "It appears you are not lying after all. What a shame. I was looking forward to having you killed. How did you do it?"
"My tech magi. It was they who did the calculations," said Scryvok.
A flagrant lie. This was the hardest part, obscuring the source of the information.
"Pleasing, is it not?"
"They have done well. I will reward them," said Krukesh.
"Not necessary," said Scryvok smoothly. "I have already done so, my lord."
"According to Lord Scryvok's data, we have only a few moments, my lord," said the Master of Teleportations.
"Wait," said Krukesh. "I want to watch this Iron Warrior. He may reveal something to us."
The sound of the image was patchy, the voices of the men in the chamber thin and echoing. They could catch none of the conversation between the warsmith and the tech magos who worked with him. The image rippled.
"You must go now, Krukesh," urged Scryvok. "My Mechanicum contingent have no clear idea how long the window will remain open, but it will not last forever."
Krukesh took a last look at the hololith.
"Very well," he said.
His helm cowl, decorated with bat wings, as his battleplate helm also was bolted into place over his head. He held out his arms so that his lightning claws could be placed upon his hands.
"To the pods," he ordered. "This better not be some kind of trick, Scryvok," he added dangerously. "I did offer to lead the strike," said Scryvok, "to prove my confidence and my loyalty to you, Lord Krukesh."
"You did. Of course, it could be a double bluff."
His voice growled out of the vox grill of his helmet. As with all aspects of the Night Lord's battle gear, the voice distortion was intended to frighten.
"If I were not to take a few matters on faith, we would never get anything done. Provost, order the attack. We'll catch them by surprise."
A tattooed serf officer snapped a crisp bow. The Terminators were all within the egg-shaped teleport pods. The pods' interiors were white, but glowed luridly in sterilizing ultraviolet light. The illumination was unnatural-looking, the teleport deck dark outside the pods. It always reminded Scryvok of home. Krukesh walked into his and pointed one massive claw at Scryvok.
"I suppose, if this works, I better stand by my promise," said Krukesh. "Maybe we can put aside our differences."
Scryvok bowed.
"It is my wish only to serve you, my Lord Caroptera," said Scryvok.
"Yes, well, there is a chance your conciliatory actions are genuine," said Krukesh. "Prepare to teleport."
Gas hissed into the chambers from wide-mouthed vents as the doors of the pods shut on hissing pneumatics. The deck crew sprang into hushed action. 40 of them were required to operate the temperamental machinery, 10 tech adepts presiding, one for each pod. The air pressure increased, similar to the growing presence of a storm. Generators in the next room pulsed with titanic power. The deck crew and tech adepts shouted to one another, ritualized announcement and response patterns that fell together with the rhythms of a shanty.
"Teleport target site locked. capacitor array primed, pod internal pressures at optimal, all systems operating within acceptable parameters,
bio patterning ready,
transmission ready, Geller apertures ready.
So they ran off their checklist, station by station, the adepts chanting their machine cant. This worship of the machine had always seemed paradoxical to Scryvok. Why had the Emperor let it persist when he had suppressed every other religion? Because he was a liar and a hypocrite, an inconvenient truth his loyal servants chose not to see.
Get on with it, thought Scryvok.
He glanced nervously at the hololith. The image quality was degrading. They did not have time to waste. Losing Krukesh had its advantages, on the surface, but Scryvok would rather the Chiroptera made it to the assault site intact. His rivals would use the loss of their commander as a convenient excuse to execute Scryvok. Whatever the outcome, he would not remain there. He had his best men stationed nearby, and his shuttle remained prepared for flight.
Engaging! Engaging!
Sang out the teleport crew in unison. Those men still possessed of human eyes flipped thick goggles of smoked glass over their faces. Servitors threw massive lever switches. The whine of power reached a crescendo. Harsh, white illumination glared from the narrow windows set into the pod doors, building from a couple of blinks a second to a headache-inducing flicker that pulsed faster and faster, but never became a solid light. The teeth-crawling sensation of active warp technology afflicted Scryvok. An odd scent penetrated his helm's mask. For a chilling second, he thought he heard laughter, and he knew that the demon was amused. The light blazed. Scryvok shielded his eyes.
Teleport successful. Shutting down. Shutting down.
The light shut out. The weirding left. It did not cease. Scryvok thought that it was always there, somewhere, but it moved on from the deck, a powerful, unseen entity departing. The pods hissed open, empty. Quietly, and without drawing attention to himself, Scryvok exited the teleport deck and headed to the embarkation deck. With the political situation as fluid as it was, he would be safer in combat.
Throw them back! Roared Pollux from atop the metal wall. Do not allow them into the mountain!
His lightkeepers stood shoulder to shoulder in the tunnel entrance. There had been 40 of them assigned to the fortress observatory of the Emperor's Watch, 20 of his own most trusted veterans, and 20 others drawn from the refugee members of the Broken Legions. Gilliman had intended that all of his allies feel trusted. It was a diplomatic move more than a practical defense. Pollux gave silent thanks for politics. Without the lightkeepers, the mountain would be lost. Several had fallen. The paint of those left was scorched brown and black with a week of constant fighting. There was little difference between the bright yellow of his imperial fists, the somber black of the Raven Guard and Iron Fists, the white of the White Scars, or the green of the Salamanders. They were true brothers now, liveried in the colors of war. All over the mountain, the Night Lords attacked. Pollux had left 6 major entrances open into the Pharos, more than he liked, but 2 of them were too big and awkward to block with landslides. Dantioch had vetoed the destruction of the tunnels themselves, and, as it was, the blocking of so many entrances had compromised the strength of the beacon. 6 entrances. 1 was at the mountain's summit. Opening only onto the promontory, it was unassailable from the ground now the funicular was gone. Fire from the Emperor's Watch kept that area free from airborne assault. That left 5 to defend. 3 were low down the mountain and most at risk. 1 was held by the unwilling Mechanicum's remaining automata and their meagre number of Thalaxii guardians. Another of the lowermost was protected by Sergeant Solus and half of the surviving 199th. And then there was this, a high slash in the southern face of the great mountain wall, and the most at risk. Pollux deduced the enemy would concentrate their main attack there and had constructed a rampart across the cave mouth. In matters of siege, he was rarely wrong. A sentry gun went up with a bang, its remaining rounds cracking off like celebratory fireworks. A trio of dreadnoughts led the way, their sarcophagi hung with the bloody remains of recent victims.
Bring the ancients down,
ordered Pollux. Bolt rounds blew in profusion off his shield. The energy field generator had failed several minutes ago, stressed too far by the amount of incoming fire. Three las cannon beams stabbed out from the rampart. Two slammed into the lead dreadnought, but it shrugged them off. Glowing holes shone in its armor. The third caught the dreadnought protecting the lead machine's left flank. Its shoulder joint came apart in a spray of liquid metal and electrical discharge, and its arm hung limply at its side. It staggered, then advanced with its brothers.
"Again! Again!" ordered Pollux.
Jet bikes roared past the cave mouth, strafing the metal bulwark. Pollux had sighted his defense carefully, giving the warriors manning it enough firing options without exposing them to the enemy outside. A seething tide of Night Lords came up the mountain. Preliminary bombardment had scoured the forest and the minefields it concealed away. Unmanned sentry guns and concealed snipers thinned the enemy's ranks, but there were so many Night Lords. The dreadnoughts were 30 meters away and closing steadily. The slope here was shallow, too treacherous for siege tanks, but not quite the defender's gift the steeper upper mountainsides were.
"Bring them down! Concentrate fire on the lead. Follow my targeting information. Mark!"
Pollux highlighted the head and joints of the oncoming dreadnought unit leader with his auto-sensors.
"Squad 3, rad grenades!"
A hail of fist-sized missiles were tossed out over the wall's sloping parapet. These were meant for the following legionaries, not their entombed brethren. They exploded with minimal force, spreading deadly clouds of intense, short-lived gamma radiation all down the mountain. The danger registered in the foe's auto-sensors, and they were pushed together into narrow, invisible corridors as they tried to avoid the new hot zones.
"Support squad, open fire! Squads 3, 4, and 7, fire sweep rad-free zones!"
Pollux kept his commands simple, brief, lacking the adornment others used. He suppressed his Inuit accent, speaking the clearest Gothic he could so that all the legionaries would understand, wherever they hailed from. This was perhaps unnecessary, even had they not understood him. Pollux fed an information-rich stream of combat data to the visors of all the legionaries under his command. The habit of his legion was to leave nothing to chance. Muzzle flashes sparkled along the length of the 40-meter wall, spearing from gun loops and parapet alike. The heavy support squad adjusted the coherence patterns on their las beams and fired again. Four beams connected with the first dreadnought, smashing its helmet, sending its arm spinning free, and punching through its sarcophagus. Its power plant detonated, sending hot metal scything out into the Night Lords. A second fell a moment later, one leg reduced to a tangled metal stump. It fell forwards onto its front, howling out its anger. The third, that previously injured, did not last long after that. The dreadnoughts were an obvious threat to the wall and had to be dealt with, but their advance had screened 100 legionaries who were now closing to close assault range. The ancient sacrifice had been calculated. Some of the warriors carried lightweight ladders or grapnels. They flung these up against the wall as their brethren slammed melter bombs and shaped charges against the outer plating or brought las cutters into play. The amount of firepower being traded was horrendous. So many bolt rounds flew between the lines that they hit each other, the space between the opposing forces filling with small explosions. Three of Pollux's men fell. Ruby beams of las cannons turned Night Lords into smoking piles of armor in return.
"Captain!"
Pollux was signaled by Chokis, the sole white scar in his lightkeepers.
"The lower gallery is breached!"
"Fall back!"
ordered Pollux. Chokis would not like the order, but would obey.
"Everyone, fall back to the second line!"
The enemy crested the wall. Pollux swung his massive power fist into the face of a Night Lord as he emerged over the parapet. The Nostraman's head vanished in a mist of metal and carbon atoms. The body fell backwards. Pollux used the edge of his storm shield to push the ladder down.
"Fall back!"
Men either side of him left their positions, firing as they went. A dozen came out from the wall interior, lined up in the tunnel, and raked wall top and wall door with fire as their fellows retreated behind them. They departed with their faces to the enemy, their guns never silent. Pollux surveyed the scene. He calculated 190 dead Night Lords, 3 downed Dreadnoughts. His defense force had lost 10. An acceptable trade, were he facing an equal force, but he had far less coin of that nature to spend than the enemy. He left with the last Space Marines. Night Lords were coming over the parapet unopposed. He slammed one in the chest, killed another near the stairs. A third leapt at him from the parapet, sword drawn, but he fell away before Pollux could strike, slain by covering fire. The stairs off the wall beckoned. Deeper in the tunnel was a second wall with fresh defenders fronted by a minefield. The tunnels were endless, and Pollux had laid them all the way in with traps. If the Night Lords ever found their way to any of the primary locations, they would pay for every step in blood. There was a flash, a curious sense of weightlessness, and Pollux realized he was sailing through the air just as he connected hard with the smooth tunnel wall. The rampart reared high, sundered in the middle, and crashed back to the rock in smoking ruin. Fire billowed out from the fortification, concentrated into a fierce tongue by the tunnel. Pollux's head rang, and blood pooled under his tongue. 4 more of his men were down. 12 Night Lords had been caught in the blast. Pollux could not understand the kind of commander that would throw the lives of his troops away in such a manner. More were coming, running through the wreckage, 12 sailing down through the air on roaring jump packs. Pollux swayed to his feet. A few of his warriors were in the same difficulty, isolated from their fellows and unable to make the wall of covering loyalists. The Space Marines deeper in saw his predicament and stood firm, firing so much their bolters glowed with the heat of discharge. They downed Night Lords as they poured through the breached wall by the dozen, but were felled in turn, having no fortifications to shelter behind. Raptors landed all around Pollux. A deadly punch crushed the torso of a Night Lord, slew a second. 3 he vaporized with his fists underslung Meltagun. But there were too many to fight, and they surrounded the captain in a ring of leering gargoyle masks and obscene trophies. His men called out for him, and many turned back to his aid. Pollux assessed the situation as he fought. If his men came to him, they would fail. Depleted of defenders, the second line would be lost.
Fall back! Leave me!
The Space Marines hesitated.
Leave me!
Pollux slew another foe. His power plant was hot on his back, running past its safety limits, supplying energy to his fist. The raptors were all around him. The few of his own warriors trapped alongside him were slain. Reluctantly, the others fell back, firing at Pollux's assailants where they could. And then they were gone, back into the safety of the mountain. Raising his fist and shield, Pollux charged.
Watch the third engine, commanded Dantioch. Do not allow it to go above 70% total output.
The Pharos light is dim, complained Magos Carantine.
As he spoke, his second voice of Binaric chittered instructions to his servitors.
We have lost much capacity because of the landslides. Blocking the apertures has compromised the efficacy of the beam.
It is enough. Corvo is locked in the transit beam. He will be here in a few hours.
The mountain shuddered under an impact.
The 8th become careless. We must hold on only for a while longer. Captain Corvo's reinforcements will allow us to prevail.
Carantine worked a whole bank of machines, mecha dendrites waving over his back to plunge unerringly into data ports. 9 servitors worked alongside him with unusual speed, impelled by his augmentically enhanced brain.
I am not a strategist, but he comes with 2,500 against 20,000.
It will be enough to stymie them until Lord Gilliman comes, said Dantioch.
He limped up and down the wall of Mechanicum machines, casting a critical eye over the work of his own subordinates, offering rebukes or direction where needed.
All we need do is reinforce the mountain.
But they must get into the mountain.
There is a way, said Dantioch.
Battle noise sounded through the chamber, sometimes amplified, sometimes dulled by the Pharos's odd acoustic properties. Dantioch had grown used to it and did not let it distract him from his task.
It is vital that the transit beam is maintained. A sudden loss will be catastrophic to the fleet, he scolded one technician.
He leaned in to readjust the Mechanicum focusing array installed in an unimportant-seeming chamber 100 meters below. This substream must not decohere.
I am sorry, Lord Dantioch, said the man.
The warsmith continued his pained circuit. He had not departed primary location Alpha since the invasion began, too anxious of mishap to leave the machines in the hands of his servants, especially with Pollux leading the mountain's defense. He was irritable. Part of him wished to be fighting again, to be free of the forest's obtuse alien technologies. He walked past Carantine and his host of lobotomized slaves. It took all of Dantioch's considerable will not to check the Magos's work too. His concentration fully occupied, he did not see the greasy curl of teleport vapor gather itself at the rear of the tuning stage. His first warning was the bark of a bolter as one of his sentries opened fire. Half a dozen guns replied. The warrior crashed down. Dantioch turned, pain gripping his side. A group of warriors garbed in cataphractii terminator plate stood at the back of the room, the teleport glimmer fading from the planes of their armor. They had not come through unharmed. One was buried halfway in the floor, his flesh and armor fused to the stone. Another stood motionlessly, his armor crumpled. A third had arrived around his armor, his viscera steaming on the outside of his stretched skin. Appallingly, this last lived for long seconds. The organs twitched with dying circulation. An agonized mewling came from somewhere within the scarlet folds of gore. There were still 8 of them, all in the bulky warplate. 7 veterans, their armor decorated with images of horror and death, and an officer sporting a crest of red bat wings upon his cowling. There were 4 ultramarines in the chamber with the warsmith. All were killed quickly, blasted apart by concentrated bolter fire, while their own rounds exploded on the cataphractii's energy fields or bounced from their thick armor. Carantine was not given the option to surrender. His weak spots were expertly targeted, his cranium, power plant, and organ flasks. All were blown apart, and he fell to pieces without the chance to speak. His servitors froze as their data link was severed.
"Do not cry out or call for aid," said their leader, in a voice made grating and ugly by his vox grill.
"If I were to, you would perish," said Dantioch.
"I think not. My entire force assaults your mountain. I have 500 of my finest about to breach the nearest entrance. There cannot be more than 40 warriors between there and this location. The ways through this mountain are not easily traversed," said Dantioch.
The leader walked towards Dantioch, examining the room. He looked longest at the Mechanicum machine banks. He said nothing for a moment, conferring privately with his warriors. 3 of them stumped off towards the only entrance into the mountain from primary location Alpha. 3 more went out onto the promontory outside the cave. There, steps led up to Pollux's fortress. If they tried that road, Dantioch didn't rate their chances. He willed them to try it. The remaining pair came to flank their leader. His commands done, the leader returned his attention to Dantioch.
"I am Krukesh the Pale, Chiroptera of the 8th Legion and the champion in the war against the False Emperor. I claim this facility in the name of Horus, rightful ruler of mankind."
"I do not recognize Horus as my master."
"That will change."
"Will it? You cannot win."
"Dear Dantioch, does our presence here not suggest we already have?" said Krukesh. "You only delay the inevitable."
"You will never get out of this chamber."
"I do not think that really matters, do you, Warsmith? I suppose you are going to be tediously intransigent when I ask you to explain the workings of the beacon, so we shall move on to your interrogation."
He gestured at Dantioch.
"Take him. We will make him talk."
As the Terminators came to Dantioch's side and painfully forced him to his knees, he cast a sidelong glance at the struggling Mechanicum machinery. Whole fields of indicator lights glowed red. Without tending, the transit beam quietly failed. The beam fascinated Corvo. It dragged them through the warp at tremendous speed, and smoothly, the fleet's own immaterial drive shut down. There was little sense of the storm racking real space and Empyrean within the glorious Nova. Tranquility reigned. Wanting to better understand, Corvo had gone to his Mechanicum aides. When he asked them how it was done, they became agitated. Their augmetic eye clusters gleamed as inscrutably as always, but the faces of those less altered showed consternation at their ignorance, and their mechadendrites lashed. Exertion at distance, they said. Forced attraction multiplied by gravity lensing. The shunting of excess mass accumulated by quantum entanglement effects, allowing swifter travel through warp space. The warp offered shortcuts to locations in real space. The transit beam smoothed the way. Its mass-cancelling effect enabled a craft to exceed the relative speed of light within the warp, a doubling of advantage of speed and distance. A cascade of binaric blurts and machine sounds followed. The usual Mechanicum obfuscation when they did not know what they were talking about. They did not like having their ignorance exposed. "Was it safe?" he had asked. They replied with a collective cybernetic shrug. Nothing untoward had happened, so he could only assume that it was safe. The weighing and trading of risk was the cornerstone of successful theoretical. Still, he was not entirely comfortable. To rely upon the technology of the alien disturbed Corvo. Too many times he had fought against creatures inimical to humanity, and he had begun to form the opinion that all things associated with non-humans were unclean. This prejudice had taken root a long time ago, but it had begun to flourish after Astagar, where he had fought Lorgar's word-bearers and the warp-tainted machines they employed. In felling the corrupt warlord Titan Felgast, he had been confronted by human ingenuity suborned and perverted. Technology employed by alien species was often exotic, difficult to understand. How was it possible to tell whether that power came from the purity of material laws or through the sorceries of the warp? The road they travelled engaged with the Empyrean, and so therefore could itself be the product of so-called chaos. What little steps to damnation were they taking by using it? He put such thoughts from his mind. The Lord Primarch himself had mandated the use of the Pharos, and it had kept the 500 worlds together. Nevertheless, he could not shake his concerns entirely. He wondered if he ever would. He was glad that such considerations were not his to ponder, and the practicals that inevitably came from them belonged to others to choose. Long may it remain so, he thought to himself. Give him the easily quantified risk exchanges of bolter, blade, and battleship. Those were theoreticals he could comprehend. A shudder ran down the spine of the glorious Nova. Corvo snapped instantly out of his reverie.
Helm station, report.
Lord Captain, I have detected something disturbing.
The ship groaned and rolled sharply enough to counteract the effects of the grav plating. Corvo grabbed at the railing around his command dais for support.
We're losing speed, reported his helmsman, Matheris.
Is there a problem with our engines? Asked Corvo.
Engines are still engaged at full, reported the engineering cluster.
Tech adepts there exchanged rapid blurts of information. A rattling groan boomed across the ship.
We're gaining mass, Captain, said the command deck head Magos.
The Pharos, said shipmaster Valentian. The beam is failing. Will we be cast from the warp?
Uncertain, said the Magos.
We'll be torn to pieces, said Valentian.
Corvo had been right not to trust it.
Cut engines,
yelled the shipmaster. Full reverse thrust. Bring our speed down to safe warp engine operating parameters. Engine room, prepare immaterium drive for immediate activation. Now. The order was relayed across Corvo's modest fleet. 5 Ultramarines cruisers beside the Glorious Nova and the Watcher of the First Legion. All of them had suffered the same effects.
Too late! Cried the helmsman.
The road of light blinked out of existence.
All hands brace, said Valentian.
Reality screamed, and the fleet was cast out of the warp, still travelling at tremendous speed. As an object accelerated, so its mass increased. The Pharos enabled faster travel through the Empyrean by using its sympathetic effects to bleed the extra mass away. Now it was off, and the spilled mass of the ships returned with murderous force. Ships flipped and tumbled, their progress suddenly and catastrophically arrested. Dependent on the no-space of the Empyrean, no human craft had ever been designed to go at such a pace in the world of natural laws. It was too much for the spear of Hermia. The ship was crushed by its own mass, gone from something as light as air to the density of a neutron star in an eye blink. Its reactor detonated, the star of its death weirdly stretched by the immense velocities of the fleet. The Glorious Nova groaned. The pressure of deceleration was unbearable. For all the ship's energy fields and technological tricks, titanic forces pressed hard on Lucretius Corvo. The weight of the galaxy leaned on his chest. Men were flung forwards from their stations. Graph plating peeled away from the deck in long, curling sheets, torn free by their own energies. Servitors were ripped out of their housings. Everyone was shouting. And then, it was over. The ship adjusted to its sudden change in mass, somehow not shattering in the process.
Report, said Corvo.
He pulled himself up off the floor. Something slid from his shoulder guard. It took him a moment to realize it was one of the bridge crew. The man had been thrown from his station, his ribcage smashed to splinters upon the ultramarine's armor. Dead men and women were everywhere, flung about like dolls, impaled upon machinery on every tier of the command deck. Fires burned in several parts of the bridge. The armor glass of the gallery windows displayed massive cracks. Were it not for the warp shutters being closed, they might have failed.
Back to your stations. Report, demanded Corvo.
The living pulled themselves up. Feet crunched on broken glass. From a decimated servitor choir, a single damaged servitor repeated,
No, 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 no,
over and over again. Half of the crew were dead. Corvo stepped down from the dais. His chest was bruised. Each breath was hard. The pain subsided quickly, healed with preternatural swiftness by his transhuman physiology. He looked to the shipmaster's throne. Valentian had been reduced to a pulpy mess.
Fire crews, to the bridge. Company report. Someone get Vox and Data Squared contact with the rest of the fleet. I need fleet status now, he said.
He strode about the room, pulling the unhurt to their feet, comforting the injured brusquely. The other space marines on the command deck did the same.
The Pharos effect has been terminated, said a young ensign.
He sounded panicky, but was keeping his fear under control. Already, Corvo was judging his remaining command crew, seeing how they reacted. He had to reorganize them. They must be prepared for battle.
But we are still proceeding at just under the speed of light.
Fleet reporting in. Damage on all vessels. The spear of Hermia is gone, said Mathras. Blood ran from a cut in his scalp.
Get me full casualty reports, legionary numbers first, he said.
He meant nothing callous by it. He simply had an invasion to execute. Primary assets must be accounted for.
Cartography, give me a positional.
There are no landmarks, my lord. This will take some time.
I am aware.
Give me your best extrapolation.
Incoming transmission from the Watcher. Activate Hololith, said Mathras.
A life-size image of Company Master Alcius of the Dark Angels appeared in the air, the commander of the small detachment of the First Legion attached to Corvo's command. Surprisingly, the image of Alcius's face was crystal clear, granted an illusion of solidity Corvo had not seen in the Hololith since the storms began.
Corvo! What by the deeps is going on?
The Pharos is out.
Then it has fallen, and our task is fruitless.
Maybe, maybe not. We must proceed as before, said Corvo. Nothing has changed. We must find a way into the mountain and take it back if possible. If not, We must occupy the enemy for as long as possible until Lord Gilliman arrives. We cannot allow the Pharos to be utilized by the enemy, and it cannot be destroyed unless as an act of last resort.
We have lost a ship. We are sorely weakened, kinsmen, said Alcius.
That is irrelevant. We have lost numbers, but our momentum is largely retained. In Void War, speed is everything. We shall continue as planned.
Captain Corvo, called out his cartography officer, I have our position. At current speed, we are 9 hours out from Sotha.
That is good news, said Alcius.
It is, my lords, and it is not, said the officer.
How so?
We have to slow down, explained Corvo, or we shall overshoot, and then we will be in no position to do anything. Contact my brother captains. Inform them we shall conduct a strategic review in 25 minutes in the Strategium by Lithocast. Matheris, you are shipmaster now.